Welcome to Season 2, Episode 13 of Our Voices, Our Community. Each week, we focus on issues that are important to you and our community. We discuss social, political, and economic issues, but also arts and culture and much more. Our goal is to merge local with state and national issues that affect our lives in Roanoke, the New River Valley, and Southwest Virginia. Today is a special edition of the podcast. Election Day is next Tuesday, November 5th. We are focusing on the election today, all things election. And I'm excited. We're going to be talking with James Steele, who is a candidate for the Commonwealth Attorney for Roanoke County, and then also Senator John Edwards. And the voice you're hearing today is a little different. Robert Jeffrey is in Italy living his very best life without us, but that's okay.
You know. We need a sponsor so we can record in location.
Right. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. That nice. Would be awesome. Please. So I am Karen Jones, and today I'm joined with Catherine Stromberg.
Hello.
Will Solari.
Hello.
And Peter Balson.
Hello, everybody.
Hey, welcome. Thank y'all.
Of course.
Thank y'all for being here.
We're excited. I mean, I've been all over the road, so I'm glad to be here in Roanoke for a little bit to talk about elections. Like, that's my everyday, so I'm ready to go.
Yeah, good, good. We've got a lot of local elections happening, and of course, Virginia, all our entire General Assembly. So it's super important that we get out to vote.
Yeah.
Yes. Super important.
The next 10 years. That's what, you know, we have a lot of work to do to get people to the polls and everything in an off year election like this where not many people want to come out. But this is probably one of the most important elections we'll have in Virginia.
Right.
Because whoever wins this Tuesday is going to help with making the lines for the next decade here in Virginia. So if we want to continue with gerrymandering the way we have it now, stay at home, by all means. Ugh. If you like fighting for healthcare for 10 more years.
Yeah.
Stay home, by all means.
Yeah, I love people like Ben Klein.
Yeah.
Charging into the closed hearing where he's not invited.
A minority.
leave us with that horrible district.
If you love not living in a democracy, stay home.
Yeah. Right.
But if you don't, then please go vote.
Get out.
So this is your last chance. The democracy train is departing the building.
It is leaving. Yeah. Well, we had some exciting news in Roanoke last week. Last Monday, City Council approved 5-2 to move our city council elections from May to November. Now, I know all of us.
Not without controversy, though.
Well, right. So that's what I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about that. I mean, because it's happening, but it was kind of.
It's okay. Not official yet.
Yeah. So, well, right, because they have to vote again, I think,
they have to do an ordinance.
An ordinance, right.
Yeah.
I found the controversy to be relatively artificially generated itself, because it seemed to all generate from the lawyer, who is not an elected official the last time I checked.
You mean the city attorney?
Yes. Ah. The city attorney. Everyone who came and testified was in support of moving it to November. There was not a soul who came and testified. Now, a couple of people were irritated that they didn't, like, you know, get a heads up that this was being proposed. But, I mean, they did get a heads up, and they, you know, this issue has been discussed to death, as the mayor pointed out. So I just find it odd that all of a sudden the city attorney seems so emotionally wedded to one particular solution.
Well,
most city attorneys would lay out several paths to get to the same place, and they would not be so oddly emotional about taking one of them. There are several legal paths to get to the same spot, and it's very clear that even years are fine legally. So the fact that he was so wedded to odd years as like the one true path was weird, especially because there wasn't much data backing it up, which was what Gina started pointing out.
Well, Robert and Sherman Jr. and Tommy talked about this a little bit at length on our last episode, and you know, applause to everyone who kept their calm during the whole thing. And you know, On the worst side, though, I think of it, it's a person demanding that things remain status quo, even though that's not their place to demand that thing.
Yeah.
on the best case scenario, there's a guy whose whole life are laws and rules, and he's not very flexible when it comes to laws and rules. And so,
but there's several the interpretation legal paths.
Of, oh, of course.
That's what's weird. Like, yeah. Don't be so like that.
But again,
was...
this is the theme of this show. How often do people have the opportunity to think creatively and progressively, and often they go, oh, that's too hard.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Just give up. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, hats off to the mayor for not putting up with
he was real stern in that.
I mean, I felt like he was very even. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he gave a little pushback where it was warranted, especially when some of the code words came out. Mm-hmm. But I thought that, you know, he did a good job. So
I think it ultimately, you know, when you look at the date of our election being in May, the very base of it is voter suppression.
Exactly.
Right. And like, you can have a lot of different ideas about why or reasons why may be better than November. But the very, very fact of the matter is we have a low turnout when we do it in May. We have a higher turnout when we do it in November. Mm-hmm. So other than that, unless there's a better reason, there's no better reason really than having more people able to vote in our elections.
Well,
like, why wouldn't we do that?
Yeah. Well, good decisions made. Next November will be fun.
Yeah, so when does that mean our next...
So for November 2020, is that what next year is?
They're gonna push it back
right.
From May which November, which makes so much sense to everyone.
Well,
I think.
It's not like anyone was jumping up to run just yet either.
Yeah, exactly. There was no process started. There was nothing, and I think that's actually a huge problem, is that people get done with the state elections and that November election, and then bam, it is like that May election is intensely upon you, and like, you still have to do your holidays and all that, and like, you know, then there's General Assembly session.
Right.
And so like, actually the chance to like push it off to November is just going to be a huge breather, so that I believe we can actually concentrate on city council instead of having this like rush to do like General Assembly and City Council elections all at the same time. Woo, too much.
Sure. Although I will say this, as someone who loves to vote, as many opportunities as possible. I understand how it can be prohibitive, but if we can vote once a month, I'd be all for it.
Don't watch American Idol or Dancing with the Stars. You can get your voting in.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
That's a whole, that's not as fun. You know, can call people citizen afterwards, like good work citizen. Like,
is that
I think
what you
that's say? Everyone who votes.
You don't get the little sticker.
Well done, citizen. Yeah.
I'm willing to give you an I voted sticker every month.
Okay.
By the way, quick poll. How many of y'all have already voted? I went in and voted at the registrar.
I should. That's a good idea.
I love voting on election day.
Yeah,
like, I feel cheated when I don't get to go and stand in line. Yeah. I mean, and I've voted absentee before, you know, because you have to. But I feel cheated if I just don't get to be at the polls.
To participate in democracy directly.
To see people.
I mean, I guess that is too, but I like the whole show.
Yeah. I think voting is fun, and I don't understand why people don't vote, because it is fun. Like, it's fun.
And it's quick.
It is quick.
Most
it's
people
easy.
Have these, like, the television, you know, when there's sometimes a line that's like an hour long. I feel like everybody gets that vision in their head, and they get to, like, I go over to Highland Park is where my precinct is, and I get in there, and there's, like, maybe one other person. So it's, like, right up in.
Right. Especially off year, you can go quick. But, I mean, but that's a problem, right? So we need to get these. I mean, and the other thing is, if people show up regularly every time, every November, which we have an election every November in Virginia, then we'll be adjusting our polling places. You know, if there's lines, they adjust. Like, Roanoke City had lines in some polling places, and they adjusted.
Yeah.
They switched things around, and they even things out to make the voting experience better. And you better bet your butt, if you regularly show up and there's a line, that they'll change it and they'll make it better for you. So keep on showing up.
Keep on.
Yeah. Well, awesome. If I may make some suggestions, though, I like the long lines too.
Oh,
because
Lordy.
The whole thing.
No.
I'm going to beat this to death because we're talking about elections this episode. In Austin, me and my writing partner would go vote together because we could sit in line for an hour and casually joke to each other and also test a crowd. So I think everyone who has a problem with long lines should just figure out creative solutions again by which to enjoy that time in line.
Comedy hour. So I completely support your attempts at comedy hour at the polls. However, I also have heard from numerous voters when I've knocked on doors how much they would enjoy being able to sit down with a ballot in the way that they do in Oregon and just go through everything. They have the vote by mail in Oregon and in Colorado. And this woman who actually just recently moved from West Virginia was telling me that she was out in Arizona visiting family, and they are friends, and they have that out there in Arizona too. And the ladies were sitting down with their ballots all together.
Adorable,
you
for
could
sure.
have a meal and do your voting and eat and then have comedy show. I mean, you could do it all. Okay,
but then everybody I can make sure everybody votes correctly.
Yeah, well, you can get into it with your own family that way. I'm not gonna get into it with your family. Let's just put it that way.
Alter their ballots.
Right. Give me that.
You get to see your neighbors, right?
Yeah.
You get to see I always inevitably run into an old school teacher or someone, and my civics teacher last time, and it was adorable again because I'm I loved you in high school. And she's I'm so glad you're voting as an adult. And it's this great thing. I think if we just again reframe the there's lines and we go to
this. It's community building.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's a wonderful experience.
I'm totally down for the election day holiday.
Yes.
I really want barbecues, I want burgers and hot dogs being given out at the precincts.
Chili everywhere.
I think that would be great.
Yeah.
I think that would be great because I would increase voter turnout if I don't have to go to work, but it would be fun.
That's right.
It would be fun. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're all crashing from our sugar high from Halloween at about, November 5th, so it'll be perfect. So then you got another high to get you back through it.
Well, and we do really have to lift up morale post-2016 election.
Oh, Lord.
I mean, anything we can do to make voting and turning out to vote seem a little bit more exciting.
I think I'll take lollipops with me.
You do it.
Yeah. And I'll hand them out in the
red, white, and blue ones.
Yeah. So they know I'm patriotic too.
Absolutely.
I tell you, it was a blast. I voted in a majority African American precinct in 2008 in Richmond, and we had a good old time in line. I think some of the people were like, "Are you okay, white people? Are you gonna be voted the right way or the wrong way?" I got a little bit of eye, but then I was clapping when people literally came out, young guys were coming out of the polls cheering, screaming, and it was so sweet. They were like, "I just voted for Obama. I just voted for a black man for president." And it was I still want to cry remembering that. And everybody got up so early, and actually it was a party in 6 a.m. And then it was all done by 9 because we literally had all voted. We had great turnout, but it was all done by 9.
So yeah, exactly. On the fence voter, if you're out there listening, think of all the magical experiences you can have when you go out and vote this November.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And get a lollipop from Karen while you're there.
Yes. Absolutely. I'm going to get the good dum-dums. Those are my favorites. Root beer. So as we kind of talk about it, there's lots of issues happening. Last Thursday, I actually had a forum called What's at Stake? And we talked about some big issues kind of for the state elections and why we need to get out. And it was really good because people were really interested. They learned a lot. I felt like they were really overwhelmed, which is why I'm going to do it again. But what do you all think is at stake in our elections this year?
Everything.
Democracy. Yeah. The end of the world. Seriously, when we talk about climate change, it's an existential crisis.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
And if we don't get these Virginia elections headed the right way, that messes up Congress, that messes up our chance for federal action, that messes up our chance for local, we can make a huge impact just on our state level, on our state level economy, on climate change. California has done a lot at their state level to work on climate change, and we could be working on it too at the state level if we get out there the right way.
And the work that Green New Deal Virginia is doing is amazing. So Karen Camplin, who is a co-chair, she was sharing with us all the legislation and then how it ties back to the economy and not just creating the jobs, putting training in. And so I need for people to see the whole big picture too, right?
Yeah.
So we want to affect and make changes to our environment and stop climate change, but recognizing it's going to make our family lives better too.
Yes, we can invest in in good things instead of in, like, giving away money to oil companies and pipelines and everything else.
I'm not going to try to get as doom and gloom as I have in previous episodes about this in regards to the impeachment and the president and all those kind of things. But one of the things you are voting on in these elections is whether you will stand by someone who believes in the Constitution, who believes in the order of law, mm-hmm. who believes in doing things the right way for people, for their best interest, whether they voted for you or not, like, you know, with Medicare in Virginia, or people who are willing to side, and literally with mm-hmm. tyranny, with people who want to subvert the laws and use, you know, whether it's a crisis in Syria or it's, you know, just the simple impeachment to subvert the United States and the Constitution, which is insane that we have mm-hmm. to, like, even think about that as an issue between, you know, rational humans.
Well, right. The Virginia state motto, Sic Semper Tyrannis.
Yeah, that's the thing. I love our state flag because of that motto. And also,
and it's
the fact,
a lady.
Yeah, that's the other reason I love it, is that it's a woman that killed him. So it might be that way because everybody's pissed about the ERA. Yes. Maybe the women come out this year and we do that same thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and again, think about that when you're, if you're not in one of our local districts, but one of the districts in Virginia where people are running as quote unquote Trump Republicans. Mm-hmm. Oh, that is a scary, mm-hmm. scary thing.
Yeah. I think between that and then just that, I'm not going to call them lies. I'm just going to call them misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
That
intentional
is being, yeah, and that's being put out there about candidates. I just read, I don't know if it was an op-ed or article, but what, about Starla Kaiser, who mm-hmm. is running in Southwest Virginia, I think in Dickinson County.
Yeah, 4th District.
Yeah, and just talking,
oh my God,
saying things about her that's just not true, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Not, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with being a California Democrat, but she's not. I mean, she's raised in Appalachia like the rest of us, you know, and so there's this intentional talk. And when I was in Richmond last week watching TV, they had a lot of commercials. Mm-hmm. But, in fact, they probably had too many commercials because I was like, if I see one more political ad, I will scream. But the Republicans, I had to pause and say, is this a Democrat or a Republican? Because they're twisting their messages and they know that that's not who they are.
Well, I call it Dirty Sturdy up in there in Richmond. Mm-hmm. Dirty Sturdy, that's how he got elected the last time. Dirty Sturdy claimed that he was all for stopping gun violence and he was all for background checks. And I'm big into background checks, he said. Well, yeah, he was big into the background checks that still exist and mm-hmm. have always existed. So he wasn't going to repeal the federal background check law. Well, shocker, that's hardly what he was communicating to the people right. when he claimed that he was a big supporter of background checks, you know, in his campaign literature last time. And now people have seen how he voted and they know that that was a lie, that mm-hmm. was misinformation that he was putting out there. And you know, same thing. So hopefully we'll see Dirty Sturdy go down.
Well, and this is a new tactic by, and it's unfortunate for moderate Republicans. I don't feel a lot of sadness for them. But if you look at their campaign signs, you know, again, unless you're running as a Trump Republican, most campaign signs are in Democratic colors, regardless whether they're Democrats or Republicans, and they don't state what their party affiliation is. Mm-hmm. And again, I like to think that it's because of, you know, the fundamental understanding that there's something wrong with their party. But if that's the case, I wish they would fix it.
So that's something we're seeing on their playbook all around the state.
Yeah.
So they are taking, you know, some of our issues, saying, oh, Medicaid expansion. Well, if you look at the votes, it was actually Democrats that got the Medicaid expansion plus a couple of Republicans. Mm-hmm. So they're taking that message that we have because they know that they're so far away from the electorate that at this point they don't put forward any of their own ideas. They just kind of co-opt ours and stay silent on a lot of the things that they're really for and strong against because they know that that's not necessarily where their electorate is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things we're seeing is, you know, you were talking, Karen, about the negative ads out in Virginia Beach. There's a flyer of Kelly Fowler literally with three MS-13 gang members next to it.
Oh my God, what? I saw that. That was messed up. This is the speaking of, so Dirty Sturdy, and then of course Ed Gillespie's playbook. This was Ed Gillespie's playbook. He tried to say that that, you know, his opponent was like a member of MS-13 mm-hmm. or something. I mean, it was bizarre. These people are trying everything, and they absolutely tried this last time in 17, and they're going for it again, and it's gross and it's racist, and they are, like, you know, hugging the Confederate flag and you know, claiming everybody's in MS-13 that has a Latino, you know, mm-hmm. Latinx last name.
Well, we get angry about that, though. What they're doing is riling up their base.
Yeah.
Because they know that this year it's all about turnout. Right. This is that off year election that nobody comes to. And that's why it's so important, Democrats out there listening, that you go and vote this year, because they are going to sit there and they're going to, excuse me, use these tactics to get their bases riled up and ready to go. And, you know, we know that Republicans turn out in these off year elections. We don't know if Democrats do.
Yeah.
So get angry. Get out there and go vote.
Go vote.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's going to be Confederate flag worship and God knows what else, you know.
Well, then you get, again, you end up, and full disclosure, I called Karen. I was like, hey, can we get Ben Klein on the show? Because I was upset that Ben Klein represents me. And again, he's another person who we didn't rally hard enough, I feel like, against. And, you know, Ben talks a very good game on Facebook. Oh, you know, this partisan circus, I want no part of it and whatever else. Because, you know, to be fair, he does represent a mixed group of people and their beliefs. And that's how I think you should be as a politician, whether you're a Democrat or Republican. But lo and behold, when a bunch of angry children barge into a room they're not invited into, guess who was part of that whole crowd?
The thing that gets me about that barging was that several of the people who were barging in were actually on the committee and invited in the room. And that is just... That kind of behavior, it's all for TV, it's all for show, it's a replay of, I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but the Brooks Brothers riot that got the election turned to George W. Bush, you know, stop the recount in Florida. That was just a bunch of white guys in Brooks Brothers outfits out there. No offense to anyone who wears Brooks Brothers.
But to Pete's point, though, that's the kind of stuff that we're fighting against, and why it's important then to get involved. Yeah. Even if you think, you know, well, Roanoke's safe, Roanoke City's safe, there's, you know, Norfolk's safe, you know, Richmond, whatever else.
No, the status quo is not safe.
It's not. And you really have to take some time to really learn about the candidates. I know that you may know somebody. So we have supervisor races in, you know, Montgomery County, and it's kind of like everybody knows everybody. And even though I think this person is a really, really nice person, I can't vote for that person.
No.
I'm not using any pronouns because I don't want anyone to know I'm talking about. But I'm not voting for that person because I know that everything really that I'm for, at the end of the day, they would be against.
Yep.
And even though they're fantastic, they've actually done some really awesome and amazing things for our community, I have to look at the bigger picture.
The voting record.
Yeah, and I think everybody needs to take more time to look at that, because, you know, our elected officials also shape our communities. Mm-hmm. And what kind of place do we want to live, right? Do we want to be accepting? Do we want to help our neighbors? Mm-hmm. Or do we want to keep our neighbors down? What is it that we're trying to do?
Yeah, and part of that is who we vote for becomes a representation of us to the outside world.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So if we don't elect leaders that reflect our values and reflect us, then, you know, we're getting misrepresented. Right. I know there are a lot of companies around the world that would love to, you know, come here to set up shop. But they have the wrong idea about folks in the western part of the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and I think, and again, and to that point, it's a philosophical, really value check when you do go out and vote. You know, again, when we're talking about Medicaid or economic prosperity, there is one group of people who are looking out for everyone, mm-hmm. whether you entirely agree with this or not. And there's another group of people that are only looking out for themselves and a very select few other people.
Yeah. And I mean, when we talk about who they're looking out for, it's basically just them continuing to get their delegate paycheck or their supervisor paycheck. They don't care. You know, it's unreal to me that there's just no thought to the broader community and the broader community's needs. And it's all about this very narrow slice of primary voters, really. really, yeah, who might get mad at them if they like improve the community at all. I mean, right, this is ridiculous. Like, community improvement is good, and some people right get mad about that. I mean, right, I've seen it in Pulaski. My dad, you know, is out in Pulaski trying to help people, you know, plan, just do some planning, some land use planning, and some lady starts yelling at him about like the UN taking over, and he's like, lady, if we could get the UN to help us out, that would be awesome. Right, Pulaski could use some UN yeah help, but they yeah are definitely not coming.
So funny.
And I think you're right on that. It's not that they're here to help everybody. I mean, if you look at the donors, I think this has been really an interesting difference between Democratic candidates and Republican candidates. If you look at the donors, everything's available on VPAP, VPAP.org. Mm-hmm. Democrats have, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of individual donors who give to their campaigns. And we see, you know, this year Democrats are outraising the Republicans, but that's why. Mm-hmm. When you look at Republicans, typically they self-fund or mm-hmm they have big special interests that drop in big
yeah
money.
Yeah.
Nick Freakus out in the 30th delegate race, he didn't even get on the ballot.
Oh,
and a billionaire from Illinois
no
dropped $500,000 into his account
no
so that he could run a write-in campaign against Ann Ridgway. And, you know, he's in a fight for his life right now, but the only way he could do that is he got $500,000 from one person.
I cannot believe that is
wow
so much money. Can you imagine if instead that billionaire was like, I'm going to give $500,000 to his district, like to just spend however they want
yeah
on whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
That would, I mean, just
right
imagine,
oh my gosh, that'd
imagine
be great
what an impact that would have on that district.
Yeah.
But no, the billionaire spent $500,000 is that right?
Yeah,
$500,000 on
yep
him running a writing campaign. He's not worth it, folks. He's crazy not worth $500,000. I can just tell you right there.
Vote Ann
Ridgway. Right. Oh my goodness.
So
well,
yeah, I guess you're what's at stake this year. We've kind of gone all over the place, but everything really is.
It is. It's a lot of big issues. We need to make sure the gerrymandering passes again.
Mm-hmm. Healthcare,
ERA.
We need to stop the voter suppression
legislation.
Yeah. Yes.
Right, voter suppression. So there's a lot kind of going on, and we need to be really attuned to what that is.
I think, so, you know, in our state, we've never really had a progressive government. We've had a Democratic mm-hmm government. It's been a moderate type of democracy. And I think that's what's really exciting about this election is if we get out there, if we do what we're supposed to and go out and vote and we win the House and the Senate,
mm-hmm,
we now have the ability to put so much of those things that John Edwards is here talking about that die in committee.
Mm-hmm.
That won't happen anymore.
Right.
And good legislation can be brought to the floor again. And then we can actually see all these things that we have been fighting for, start to change in relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm. Win-wins. I like win-wins.
Yeah.
We've been doing lose-loses for way too long.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of voting, we have some special guests here today.
We do. We are going to be joined by James Steele, who is candidate for Commonwealth Attorney in Roanoke County, and then also Senator John Edwards will be here. He represents the 21st district. So excited to have both of them here with us today also. So we are pleased today to have with us Mr. James Steele. He is a candidate for Commonwealth's Attorney for Roanoke County. James, welcome.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. So today is all about elections. And I know that Roanoke County has a lot going on, so we're excited that you agreed to be here with us and talk a little bit about why you're running. So the first question we have for you really is, what inspired you to run?
Well, several things all happened at the same time. But when I saw that this race hadn't been contested in 30 years, there was no incumbent running, and it was two people in the race already, and so if I ran, it would be a three-way race. I started doing my research, and I read book after book that were about the power of the prosecutor's office and the dire need for prosecutorial reform. And so there were several things that started me down this path, and ultimately they're not the things I talk about most of the time, but one of the biggest things that inspired me to run was this issue of mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at between 5 and 700% more people per capita than we were in the 70s. And crime has been dropping pretty steadily since the mid-90s, and it just doesn't make any sense. It's not good for the community. It's not good for our tax rate. It's just bad all around. Another thing, bail bonds, the cash bond or cash bail system, that's something that's just in dire need of reform, and it contributes quite a bit to this this mass incarceration. And then the thing that I end up talking about just nonstop now, it's honestly the only thing I talk about anymore, is our response to the drug crisis, specifically the opioid epidemic. You know, we started in 1994 or 95, we started the first drug court in the Commonwealth. And so we were leading the Commonwealth in that. But that same year, Purdue Pharma released OxyContin, and we essentially haven't changed strategy since, I think it was 1995. But every year, this problem gets worse. Every year, more and more people die, more and more people are addicted, and we've essentially been trying to lock people up to fix the problem. Mm-hmm. And I guess if we could, if it worked, I might support it, but it just hasn't been working at all.
Right, right. Understandable. I think it's interesting. I was looking today also at the, you talked about, you know, this Commonwealth attorney hadn't been contested in 30 years. And actually, most of the Commonwealth attorneys that are running now are all uncontested. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about why that is?
I think it's very hard to beat an incumbent. You know, unfortunately, I tell people I'm running for Commonwealth attorney and they say, oh, that is great. What's a Commonwealth attorney? and some other people say, oh, I know the person who used to do that job, but they're talking about the county attorney. So the way that we've named it Commonwealth attorney, while everybody else calls it a district attorney, I think it confuses people, and they just don't exactly know what it is or how important it is.
We need an episode of Law and Order on this.
Right.
And I'm just throwing it out there.
I think New Jersey actually calls it the Commonwealth attorney, maybe. And so, yeah, they could go across the river and they could point that out as a little PSA. But so a lot of people don't know about it. And so when an incumbent has a decent record, as long as people aren't that upset about it, mm-hmm. I think it's just very easy. I mean, this is my perspective as an outsider right now, but it seems like it must be easy to hold on to that seat.
Okay, that makes sense. So you talked about wanting to reduce mass incarceration, which we know people, particularly with the cash bail issue, a lot of people are in jail because they can't afford to get out. So what things might you institute or do differently to try to help with that?
Well, I mean, the cash bail, that's relatively low-hanging fruit. We've seen other jurisdictions eliminate or vastly overhaul it. And by some stats, our incarceration growth rate over the last, I think it's 10 to 15 years, mm-hmm. can be attributed almost entirely to people who are awaiting trial. So under our Constitution, they're innocent until they've been proven guilty. And so innocent people that just can't afford cash bail are sitting there. And so that's one way you can reduce a lot of the population that's sitting in jail right now. And the way I see that is, if somebody's a threat to the community, mm-hmm. there's no amount of money that I think they should be able to pay to get out on bond before their trial and threaten the community. If somebody's not a threat to the community, then there's no reason we should be making them pay anything. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's not just them making them pay bond. It's us as taxpayers. We're paying a lot of money to hold them. I see some of the reasons that the system was started, but they don't really apply anymore. And jurisdictions that have removed the cash bail system are finding that people are showing up to court at about the same rate they were before. And so I think it's just time for that system to end. There's only two countries still doing it. It's us and the Philippines.
I've I've heard that if you just text people, that that is actually much more effective in getting them to show up to court, to just a text reminder. I always appreciate a text reminder for the dentist and for court, too.
Yeah, that's when I was thinking about that. I was thinking there was a jurisdiction, I can't remember if it was Brooklyn or someplace in Kentucky. They work with text messages, and I think there's even one they offered rides. Because the number one reason my clients miss court is they just didn't have a ride.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So the other thing that, you can't fix as the Commonwealth's attorney, but we do need to fix in Virginia is our, the strength of our defense attorney system, actually helped pay for a defense attorney for someone a couple different times for like minor infractions, and where they were getting counter basically someone was upset with them and they were trying to use the court system to put out a false claim and then use kind of a scummy attorney to push that false claim and get it out through the magistrate's office and then haul them into court, and it just wasn't safe for them to be in court without an attorney. But like when you don't have the cost, like when they were trying to get them to drop other charges, like they had been the victim had been beat up, okay, that was what it actually happened, and the perpetrator was trying to put a bunch of false charges against his own victim into the system in order to get, you know, the him to basically not testify against him. I mean, it's just, it's unreal how some people abuse the system, and the need for, you know, a good, people who are truly often innocent to have a good free defense attorney. Mm-hmm. So,
and to that point, in Virginia, we have a competitive rate for our court-appointed attorneys. It's much higher than, much lower than every attorney's rate that I know, but it's still higher than a lot of states. I believe it's $90 an hour for court-appointed attorneys, and that was set more than a decade ago. Unfortunately, there's a cap. So on a misdemeanor, your max fee is $120. And so a misdemeanor is worth less than an hour and a half. And because of that cap, even though we have a high rate, we have arguably the lowest paid court-appointed attorneys in the nation. The reason I say arguably is there's a few states that don't give us the right statistics to know. But we're right at the bottom.
Wow. Gotta fix that.
And it causes, it causes injustice throughout the system and leads, I think, to over-incarceration. Mm-hmm. When people can't afford, when there's not enough good counsel, people are going to spend more time in jail than is needed.
I mean, my friend was just afraid to go into court and testify against someone who had really done a fairly egregious hate crime. And he was scared, you know, to go and testify, and was thinking about not cooperating with the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office in order to get the other guy to leave him alone. You know, it's just kind of the system where we're letting people, on the one hand, be lawless if they know how to abuse the system, and on the other hand, you know, not be protected. So it's just, we've got a lot of reforms that need to get there.
Well, I think, Catherine, you both mentioned this. I mean, what are some of the challenges? You know, you both mentioned the challenges, but what are some of the challenges in particular with Roanoke County? Because, you know, Chief Jones at one point had a little bit less of a progressive view on needle exchange and those kind of things. You know, going forward, you know, with him kind of coming around and some of the changes that are happening there, what do you kind of see as some of the bright spots in working for the county, and some of the kind of challenges since it is the county?
So I'll say, first of all, the county has a great prosecutor's office right now. Randy Leach was our prosecutor, I think, for 14 years. I really like the office that he ran. It has a much more progressive discovery policy than is required, and more progressive than many of the jurisdictions around here. The county has very low violent crime rates, relatively low property crime rates. The one thing that I think we need to change, we have to change, is our drug policy. And, well, I can't change everything that I would want to change. The prosecutor's office is limited. But as an example of something that needs to change that I don't have direct control over, I mentioned our drug courts before. And I like our drug court. It does a lot of good work. And the people that work in it are compassionate, and they're trying their best to help people who really need help. But our drug court has consistently refused to allow medicated-assisted treatment in opioid cases. Mm-hmm. I don't know all the reasons for it, but I know that throughout the Commonwealth, other jurisdictions are coming around and starting to use it. Everybody recommends it, regardless of your politics. The governor's office, the White House, the CDC, the Virginia Department of Health. Everybody recommends medicated-assisted treatment, Suboxone, methadone, etc., for these opioid cases. And the stats, the recovery stats, are just so much better. But we have consistently not allowed it. I believe there's a small pilot program going on now, but that's one of the ways that we're way behind the time. And just in general, like I said before, if we could just lock people up and it would fix it, then that'd be great. Sure. But that's exactly what we've been trying.
Well, that's the most dangerous time, right? For people when they exit having either a forced or a voluntary period of complete abstinence from opioids, when they don't have that MAT treatment. My husband actually is ex-waivered. So that means that he can prescribe the MAT treatments out of the emergency department. And he does this all the time. And now. And it's very helpful for people because the major time, he's also a toxicologist, the major time he sees opioid overdose is when people have undergone a period of abstinence, whether that abstinence was, chosen or kind of forced upon them because they're incarcerated. That's the most dangerous time if they try any opioid in that period, because then their tolerance is different and they don't know, they don't know where their tolerance is. They don't know how their body will react to the opioid if they kind of, fall back into the pattern and they die. Instead of getting a second chance to get clean again, so because a lot of people will relapse and then want to get sober again. So, that MAT can kind of get them, can even them out.
Yeah. And just as an aside, I'll say, I believe our spouses work together.
Yeah.
My wife is also ex-waivered, and it changed her outlook so much. She had all of these patients coming to the emergency room, and they had a clear opioid problem. But there was nothing really she could do. Good luck. Try to find a clinic that'll help you and have a nice life. But when she got that X waiver, she can now prescribe a couple of days of Suboxone. And then through the Bridge program, Doctors Hartman, they run this great program, and they guarantee somebody who's sent there from the ER, I believe, will be seen in 3 days.
Nice.
And then the show-up rate is better than 80% right now. People are going, they're getting this medication that staves off dope sickness for a few days, and then they're getting into treatment.
Yeah, the other thing that I've heard from some harm reductionists that we've had on before is that when you do over-incarcerate people, even when you're going after people who are some people say we should go after the drug dealers and not the users. So, but what he says is that when you do that, what you do is you actually interrupt the supply, and that then the supply is adulterated, and you will see a round of deaths because of adulterated supply, that it makes the supply more toxic and it makes the supply more likely to be adulterated, and so people end up with infections. So which is also something we've seen a lot of, and every time our call him our beloved chief, I believe, on here. Every time our beloved chief goes through a round of lock 'em ups on drug dealers, actually we need to find some sort of system like the MAT to kind of talk to drug dealers and get them to, maybe do less harmful behavior, but locking them up actually causes greater harm to the users.
Well, I think on something like this, the MAT is probably the best answer, at least on opioids. Unfortunately, there's no real MAT for cocaine or meth. But with opioids, somebody, a user who has access to something, this medication that will keep them not only stay off dope sickness, but also it counteracts additional opioids, and so it can prevent it can prevent overdose. I think that's the solution. I'm not going to say that I'm not going to go after drug dealers. I think it's critical. It's just not the answer to the drug problem.
Yeah, we just have to find some way of incentivizing them to be doing something less harmful. Like, you know, this harm reduction approach, I'm really into it. Like that oftentimes our approach is, even when we're trying to do good, like my dad has this saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And he's always told me that. And so I really take that seriously. Like, it, you know, you can have great intentions, and people had great intentions when they prescribed opioids to begin with. They had the great intention of, they were told, you know, you need to treat pain better. And they were told that and told that and told that in medical school. And I'm sure your wife was too, you know, everyone was. And, you know, that was the intention. And our intention here is to stop drug dealing, but we're not actually stopping drug dealing, and we're making it more harmful. So we just have to have, no matter our intentions, we have to have harm reduction, I think.
I agree with the overall point. I don't think the purpose of going after drug dealers is to stop the drug trade. It just doesn't work. There's too much money. It's too much incentive. Somebody will always fill the gaps. So if you want to actually address the problem, I think you've got to reduce the demand.
Yeah.
If you reduce the demand by getting users help, then hopefully that will affect the supply. I don't think you can ignore the supply, because these are people that have chosen to risk other people's lives, and knowing that people will die for profit. And that goes down to the dealer on the street up to Purdue Pharma.
I mean, I just have a very jaded view of that, because I see people in my community dealing guns totally legally every day, and they are absolutely risking people's lives for profit. Nobody cares. So, you know, that's just me.
Which is a crazy viewpoint from you, since you're such a gun supporter.
I know. I love a good shooting range. Nothing like eating lead in the morning.
And if you could tell us briefly, you know, it's not a real crowded stage, but like you said, you're running against two other people for this position. Really, you know, what stands out? What should people know about you that really differentiates you from the rest of the crowd?
Yeah, so it is a three-way race, and I guess one of the reasons I mentioned before, I talk about drugs nonstop. It's not because that's the only thing the prosecutor's office does, but that is the thing that differentiates me from my opponents in this case. My Republican opponent, he has some experience in that office, and he knows, just like I've already said, that it was a good office to start with, and I think he's just planning on keeping the status quo, which, again, other than the drug issue, I like the status quo in that office pretty well. And the cash bail. But what really differentiates us is how we're going to handle drugs. And the other thing, you know, he has some prior prosecutorial experience as an assistant prosecutor. I have experience running an office. Right now, my office, I guess there's four of us attorneys right now in two different offices, one in Roanoke, one in Henrico. I think we're down to three staff right now. But, you know, I think out of the three candidates, I'm the only one with experience actually managing multiple attorneys and staff members and throughout multiple offices. And then I guess the third opponent, he's running as an independent, but in his own words, a very right-leaning independent. And so I guess you've got the status quo represented by the Republican candidate, the independent, I don't want to speak for him, but seems to want to move to the right of the status quo. And then I don't necessarily see my position as left or right, but I certainly support a progressive approach to the things I've mentioned, drugs and cash bail.
Yeah. So the other thing that is a huge issue that I've seen around here that we just don't address, that the prosecutor's office has really been bad at in Roanoke City, is the domestic violence issue. So I don't know anything about how the Roanoke County handles domestic violence. It's a super complicated issue. I don't know if you have a view on that or not.
Domestic violence, it doesn't matter which prosecutor's office you're talking about, there's a real problem. Only a small fraction of the crimes that are committed are prosecuted at all, and only a small fraction of those that are prosecuted lead to the convictions that there ought to be. I don't think it's a problem with our prosecutors. I think they do a great job, but they're very difficult cases to prosecute. And historically, it's been underreported. And then when it has been reported, I think this is changing, but there's just been a lack of people believing victims and just being very dismissive.
Yeah. So one thing I do know that relates to the gun issue that I follow really closely is that some of the Commonwealth's attorneys are supporting these. They're basically laws that would allow you to get like a domestic violence restraining order, but it's specifically for gun ownership. So someone who's showing violent tendencies or towards themselves or others, that the Commonwealth's attorney and or the police would be able to initiate a process where it would be like an evidentiary hearing. Where you would go in and you would basically have that person's gun rights temporarily removed, and you would have that person, and then they could go back and have them reestablished later. But it would be a chance, because I know a lot of women fear that they will be harmed, and that's why they don't cooperate. Victims of domestic violence generally, usually women and kids, that's why they don't cooperate, and that's why they're so hard to prosecute. Mm-hmm. But would you support something like that?
I would. I mean, there's already a framework in place when somebody is demonstrates violent tendencies. There's a framework for through the restraining order.
You're right. So you're right. But judges often don't use it. Maybe because Commonwealth attorneys aren't asking for that often enough. I have no idea. Are Commonwealth attorneys usually involved in the restraining order process?
I'll be honest. That part of the court. Is private for the most part, unless you have a reason to be in that room. You're not in that room, and I have done very little on the domestic side of it. I will say this: I had a conversation with the director over at SARA on Brambleton, and I asked them specifically as I was preparing for this race what they thought about how Roanoke County specifically was handling domestic violence and sexual assault specifically, and. And they were overall pleased with the way it's been going. And so, again, to the extent that Roanoke County's been doing things right, I want to continue that. But we know, like I said, nationwide, there needs to be more focus on this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, James, finally, we're talking to everybody about voting today. What's your words of encouragement for everybody to get out and to vote? Whether it's a Commonwealth attorney, whether it's for, your state senator or whatever else, what's your hot take on it?
Well, I mean, not to be too repetitive here, but no incumbent in my race, with no incumbent and with a three-way race and a race that hasn't been challenged in 30 years, we have never had a better opportunity to make positive change. Mm-hmm. I think this is a remarkable election. And so there's so much. Again, I'm really biased here because I'm running for Commonwealth attorney. But there's so much the Commonwealth's Attorney Office can do either to help or to hurt a community. And again, I like our Commonwealth's Attorney's Office, but to miss an opportunity to improve it is, we could be letting down our community for decades to come because it's very hard to change things once somebody's in. I think we've got a once in decade opportunity right now.
Fantastic.
Wonderful. Oh, thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate it. And I know that everyone that hears is going to go out and vote for you.
Yeah, and please help us find a good Commonwealth attorney candidate in Roanoke City. Thank you very much.
good luck with the race.
Yes, good luck.
Thank you so
you.
Much. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Okay. Thanks. So we are here now with Senator John Edwards. Senator Edwards represents the 21st District in the Commonwealth, which covers most of Roanoke City, Roanoke County, Salem, parts of Montgomery.
It covers all of Roanoke City,
part
of Roanoke County, most of Montgomery County, and all of Giles County.
Gotcha. Okay. See, y'all, I get confused. Get confused easily. So, Senator Edwards, thank you so much for being with us today.
Delighted to be here.
Thank you. So today's all about, we're talking about elections, getting people out to vote, and so we're excited to have you here to share with us today.
So, yeah, what's at stake? What's on the ballot? Besides you.
The soul of America.
Pretty much.
I mean, nationally, but also here in Virginia, we're one vote shy in the House and one vote shy in the Senate. We need to take both the House and the Senate because we can't make any progress otherwise on a whole laundry list of things. Since the blue wave of 2017, we got Medicaid expanded, but it took two and a half months after the session in 2018 to make that happen. And it was not easy, believe me, because the Republicans in the House and the Senate know how to gerrymander, so to speak, the committees. Like for this, in the Finance Committee in the Senate, there are 11 Republicans and 5 Democrats. It's that type of thing. So we got to get, and the ERA should have passed, but it didn't pass because it passed the Senate, but it went to the House and it got killed like 4-3 in a subcommittee. Right. That's the kind of thing that's been happening. So to get anything done, we need to have a supermajority in both the House and the Senate. And I think it's going to happen. At least I certainly hope so.
Yeah. And we've seen that there are now Republicans out there who have their constituents believing that they voted for Medicaid expansion. I mean, it is unreal. Yeah. People at the doors are saying, oh, well, I'm going to vote for him again because he got me Medicaid. No, he did not. That was the Democrats. Thank you very much.
Also, teacher pay raises.
Oh, God, no. They're saying they got that, too? No. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
There's
for example, we finally got 5% raise, but it's been 6 years.
Right. Yeah.
And we need to do a whole lot better than that, too.
Right.
And we needed Medicaid expansion to do that.
Well, 5 years to get Medicaid expansion. We could have done it January 1st, 2014, effective that date. But guess what? It didn't happen until January the 1st, 2019 this year. So we lost 5 years of close to $2 billion of federal money. We've already sent it to Washington. They could have come back to help the economy, not to speak of the fact that, you know, up to 400,000 citizens who are pretty soon going to be covered by Medicaid expansion never got covered.
I did notice that right after that Medicaid expansion came through that suddenly Carilion's building a new bed tower and there's all sorts of construction happening.
That's true.
That's pretty exciting, and they're hiring, and you know, things are looking good. I will say that of the number one employer.
Yeah, and can you speak to some of those challenges? Because, you know, Virginia is kind of still a fairly divided state, even though it's pretty neck and neck. You know, some of the challenges that you've had in the Senate trying to get, you know, just very common sense things passed because of the Republican majority in the Senate and the House.
That's exactly right. I-81, for example. They call it the I-81 fix. Actually, it was a fix for all the interstates, but not a fix for the rural roads. But we finally got something done this year, but not because it got added in a committee. What happened was this year, the governor, and I worked with him very closely after the session was over, came up with a package that was an up or down vote that we thought would pass both the House and the Senate. So at the veto session with the lieutenant governor, you know, we were able to get an amendment to the budget bill that it added I-81 and an amendment to the a bill that was a study only. And that's, so we put money on the study bill, and that's how we got it done. Over $2 billion for the interstates, not just I-81, but most of the, all the interstates, plus I-81 got the vast majority because 41% of all truck traffic on the interstates is I-81. Mm-hmm. And so we got the vast majority of that, but it was not easy. It was a matter of what would work, and we had to get the rest of the state involved, and Northern Virginia wanted $20 million out of the package because they had a hole in whatever they were doing. And they also wouldn't have passed without the 2.1% on I-81, the $60 million for I-81, that a lot of Republicans would not vote for because of the gas and diesel tax on the localities all up and down I-81. But that was critical to get the votes from Northern Virginia because they have that same tax on their interstate. So it was a complicated thing, but it only happened because it didn't come out of the General Assembly. It only happened because the governor, to his credit, and Shannon Valentine, the Secretary of Transportation, and others, and I was involved in the discussions the whole way, finally came up with something we thought would pass, and by golly, it did pass. But it wasn't easy. It was only in the veto session when it was up or down vote. We had to bypass the committees. That's the whole point.
Would you say that the committees are almost used as kind of an obstructionist tool?
They are.
I mean that seemed to be the case with the gun laws and all that kind of stuff, too.
The ERA, for example, is a good example.
Oh, yeah.
That's just one good example. And there are other examples as well.
So, well, I will say on the gun bills, you have put in some great bills to give localities power to protect their citizens lately. I mean, especially in Roanoke City, we've seen how people showing up to the, you know, to city council meetings, people parading around on our streets with AR-15s, AKs, that, you know, we've had some problems. Yeah. And, you know, if you want to go parade, you know, in Giles with an AR and nobody cares, that's your business, I guess. But, you know, people in Roanoke City really did care and didn't like people showing up to city council with guns. And so I really appreciate the bills that you've put in, and they're really strong, really great bills that would help us get, you know, increase our safety at the local level and give our and empower our local officials. And I've just those bills are great bills, and I really hope that we're able to get you some colleagues in those committees so that they can get through. Not so because I'm really so appreciative.
Not a single Republican vote for any of them.
Yep.
I find, how do you? Because I know how difficult it is for me trying to work with some of our Republican leadership kind of in Southwest Virginia. Yeah. So how do you, or can you break those barriers? Because I know, I think you and Sam Russell and Chris Hurst are really the only Democrats in Southwest Virginia.
Exactly right.
So how do we break through some of those barriers? Because, I mean, I just think what's good, we all should be working for what's good for Southwest Virginia.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Well, I think that you talk about infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Everybody needs roads. Mm-hmm. And even the people that voted against the roads would say, yeah, we do need roads, but let the federal government do the job. Well, we can't rely on the federal government either.
Right.
So, and schools. For example, last year, six of the localities in Southwest Virginia were losing students, and therefore they were not getting the share they normally would get from the state. Mm-hmm. So we came up with $6 million, Republicans and Democrats together, on top of for the budget for these six localities. Otherwise, they really couldn't keep the schools running like they should be doing. And so we do work together on a lot of things that are local like that.
I mean, they just should not have control of the committees because they make it impossible. I mean, I think you guys could do a lot of good work with them once they're not in charge of the committees anymore. And then you can, I mean, you can honestly, like when you guys push that to the floor, you saw a lot of them voted for Medicaid expansion, right?
Yeah,
I mean, so once it's happening, they're all like, well, maybe we should get on board now. But
Equal Rights Amendment is a good example. It got out of the Senate 26 votes. It went to the House, went to a subcommittee, it killed 43. That means 93 House members couldn't vote for it.
Right.
They didn't have a chance to vote for it. It would have passed, and they knew that.
Right.
Hmm. So. One of the things that you're well known for is bringing the Amtrak here to Roanoke. I know that you've been trying to push to get that down into Blacksburg, Christiansburg area.
Right.
If we're able to take over the House and Senate, do you think that'll be easier? And where does that project kind of stand right now?
Well, a lot of things would be easier. But that particular project, I know Shannon Valentine, the DRPT Division, Department of Rail and Public Transportation, been trying to get Amtrak to Christiansburg. The problem had actually been Norfolk Southern. It's their line. They're not particularly interested. We've already come up with $350,000 to study the line with Norfolk Southern subcontractor. And then when we find what needs to be done, we'll come up with how much, we don't know, several million dollars probably, to improve the line between Roanoke and Christiansburg, which is only 35 miles. That's the problem. If we can convince Norfolk Southern to go ahead and spend that $350,000, see what needs to be done, then we can move forward fairly quickly after that. But right now, that's been the problem.
Mm-hmm. I think this touches on part of it. You know, people being focused so usually on national elections and national issues. Yeah, I think sort of underscore the importance of state and local issues. I mean, could you speak to a little bit? I mean, again, because while this seems like a minor thing, it does connect all of Southwest Virginia. You know, even minor things like the train then become a national thing. Could you speak to sort of the importance of state and local issues?
Well, more and more, the national issues in the sense of intransigence has become, Washington's moved to Richmond, so to speak. It used to be the General Assembly was not like that. In 2004, with the Warner Tax Reform Plan, the Senate passed a transportation package as well as the general fund package of Governor Warner. And the Senate, the transportation package that the Senate on a bipartisan basis, the Republicans had 23 and we had 17, so we our 17 and 16 of theirs voted for transportation. It went to the House, they wouldn't consider it, and it had to be killed. Mm-hmm. We got a general fund package done because of Governor Warner, and he did a lot of work getting that because the House was controlled by the Republicans as well. But they had a lot of moderate Republicans then in the House and the Senate. But even the House would not go with the transportation package. So the point is, with moderate Republicans, we got something done back in 04, for example, with Governor mm-hmm. Warner was governor. And there were moderates who were willing to raise taxes if necessary. They don't exist anymore. They're gone. And the Tea Party is running the Republican Party, let's face it, along with the NRA. And they've become ideologically intransigent. It kind of reminds me a little bit in 1933 when Roosevelt was elected. He ran against Herbert Hoover. And Roosevelt said, we got to do something using government to solve the problem of the Depression. Where Herbert Hoover was ideologically blind, he said, it's a free enterprise system. We can't use government, period. And so he had no solution.
Oh my gosh.
And that's the difference between somebody who's willing to try something. Mm-hmm. And Roosevelt admitted, I don't have the absolute solution. But look what happened in the 30s with the securities reforms, securities laws, the Social Security, the Civilian Conservation Corps. That mm-hmm. built the Blue Ridge Parkway. Oh, so many great things were done with government to help people. Mm-hmm. But Herbert Hoover said, basically, I have no ideas.
Sure.
And that's why he got defeated.
Yeah, and let the businessmen loot everything. And who cares if people are starving,
well,
right?
Well, trickle-down doesn't work.
Yeah. And it didn't work then. It doesn't work now.
Even Alan Greenspan, who's a great high apostle of right-wing mm-hmm. Economics, head of the Federal Reserve System, for many years, even he said on television that if you cut taxes for the rich, it does not translate into creating jobs. He said, right. It doesn't work like that. That's not how you build an economy.
Right.
And yet they continue trying to do that.
And it leads to huge deficits, we're seeing now.
Well, yes. The deficits they complain about when it comes to spending money for social programs.
Oh, yeah.
But they don't complain about it when it's basically welfare.
When you're spending on billionaires.
Welfare for the rich and welfare for the corporations. Yeah. And
it does not
create jobs.
Well, and you've had a long career, too, of doing a lot of good things. And again, you know, you speak to sort of looking forward and trying new ideas. What are some of the things that you're you know, looking to do, you know, with this next chapter in your career as a politician?
That's a really good question. Expanding Amtrak to up to Christiansburg is very, very important. It's important for the state and not just for our region. And by the way, it'll be the second train for Roanoke. It won't be an earlier train for Roanoke. It'll be another train starting in, say, mid-morning. We're not sure when it will start, but that'll be a really important for Roanoke as well. It's also important for Virginia Tech and Amazon. I mean, Tech is building a school up in Alexandria to get the students and the faculty and others from Blacksburg to Alexandria quicker without having to fight 81. So that's something we're going to do. Another thing has to do with prescription medication. I haven't been talking much about that, but I'm on the Joint Commission on Healthcare, and I've been working all summer long on the high cost of prescription medication. It's a huge national problem. It's a bipartisan issue, and surprise billing, things like that. So I'm working with several ideas. And why can't we buy from Canada when it comes to medication?
Right.
We're working on that as well. So we're working on a whole host of things in the field of healthcare.
Yeah, you guys have a lot of power at the state level, and I'm excited to see how you can improve Virginia if we give you a few more colleagues, so, and get you back in there.
There's a lot we can do if we get the House and the Senate on right wavelength.
Sure. And we talked to James earlier about this kind of thing too. You know, what's the importance of people getting out to vote? Because, you know, I mean, sort of turnout is looking to be a little bit lower this year. You know, what would you tell people was the importance of voting, whether, again, state, local, national?
Well, the local and state governments affect people's daily lives more so than the federal government. People listen to what's going on at the federal level. Okay, they deal with foreign policy and war and peace, and they deal with the, you know, national debt issues and national tax issues and things like that. But the fact is, the General Assembly passes more laws in a two-month session than Congress does in 2 years. And with the local government, if the impact is immediate. I mean, that's where the streets street issues are. The criminal issues are mostly at the local level and not at the federal level necessarily. And we, the General Assembly, half the money for schools comes from Richmond. All the professions and occupations are regulated by the state more so than the national level. So we impact people's lives much more than the federal government does on a daily basis.
Thank you so much, Senator.
I'm also talking about solar energy.
Pushing
that big time.
The fact is,
there's more people in the solar energy industry throughout the country by a long shot than the combination of coal, oil, and natural gas combined. And it's a job creator. And of course, talk about climate change. And so I'm pushing hard to do that. We need to change the laws in Virginia, though, when it comes to solar energy. Utilities are controlling everything, and I think we need to kind of break that up a little bit. North Carolina does a better job than we in terms of solar energy because the laws there are very different.
So what are some of the things that citizens can do in that regard? You know, if I want, so I have AEP, and if I would like for AEP to use green sources, you know, solar, wind, hydroelectric, I have to pay a premium for them to use the better energy source. How do we fix things like that? If, you know,
it's got to be done at the state level. That's the thing. The utilities are very controlling. I've been pushing for things like solar gardens. For example, why can't I put a solar panel on my roof and sell it or give it to my next door neighbor? I can't because I'm not a utility. Do I look like a utility? I don't think so. But I'm not a utility. You have to be a utility to do that. That's just one example of the kind of things we need to change.
It's kind of messed up to me that these folks are monopolies, but then they have private ownership. I mean, it is wild to me that we just...
They're a regulated monopoly, quote unquote regulated monopoly.
People get mad at the utilities, but we created the law. The nation. And North Carolina allows people like I was just talking about having solar gardens, that type of thing. And the other thing has to do with when it comes to hurricanes and when it comes to trees falling down and busting the wires. We need to harden the grid, both underground, but also to solar energy can be done locally.
The only people with power in certain areas of California right now are people with solar panels because they have energy and PG&E is shutting off the regular customers. I mean, it's a messed up.
Yeah, it is a mess. The governor's been criticizing the power company in California, and I've been listening very carefully to what he's saying. He's right.
Well, it's incredible, too, because, you know, there's a lot of manufacturing here in Roanoke, whether it's, Vance Auto, Foot Levelers. You know, even big churches have these giant roofs, and they use a lot of power, and they could really just, with a very small business loan, change the entire nature of their business just by doing that.
Well, what's happening is, Quillian, for example, up in near Radford at the New River Valley hospital up there, they recently took a man's farm next door and are leasing the farm, and they put in panels to provide solar energy to the hospital there. But the way they did it, they couldn't, in order to, because of Virginia law, you can't sell to a third party unless you're a utility. What they're doing is owning the solar panels. So you hire somebody to put in the solar panels and to function and to work it, but then you own the solar panel, so you're selling to yourself. So you can do that. It's like having a panel on my roof. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting legal way they've come about to do it. But you couldn't, the man who owns the farm, he couldn't have his own solar energy there and sell it to Crillion. They couldn't do that.
We need to come up with better systems and let people be more innovative.
And when it comes to climate change, you know, we're all worried about cars and all that and the carbon that they emit, but buildings are actually the second biggest carbon emitter from the power that we get, anything like that. There are some states that do, it's called PACE financing, which is property assessed clean energy, where you can get low interest rates, companies can do this as well. There's a commercial version of it, and the loan is actually part of your title. So like when you sell the building, the loan goes with it, so that people, you know, have a little bit more security in making those investments.
I got a bill passed a couple of years ago for Roanoke City to put a solar panel on the Civic Center. There was a technical reason they couldn't do it, that we finally got the bill passed. And if they ever go about putting a solar panel on the Civic Center, the Berkman Civic Center, It'll save them maybe $1 million over a 20-year period.
That's the money we could use.
It is a lot of money. Well, you know, I think one of the things that people forget also is, you know, there is a cost associated with it, but that cost plus about 5% of the total worth of your building goes up just by having solar put in. Yeah. So you can sell your building for more, it's worth more, and I think it just makes sense for a lot of businesses like the Berglund Center or wherever else to do that.
I mean, and plus, you know, when we talk about especially our schools and our civic center and the buildings that we collectively own, we have to look at the fact that, you know, as climate change pushes, you know, stronger storms and harder storms, and that means our stormwater system has to be amped up in order to deal with these and, you know, the increased flooding. Well, you know, if we could just, you know, ameliorate some of the actual flooding by not amping up the storms even more, that would be, you know, it's just smart. We're saving money six ways. Yeah. And, you know, and you know, Republicans are always like, oh, but look at the cost. It cost me $1 to save these $10.
Well, you know, the people forget that the Atlantic Fleet is located in Norfolk. It's the for the Navy. Mm-hmm. And the Navy has said the number one issue for them is climate change.
Yeah,
and the waters are rising in Norfolk, and they can document that happening. And they're very concerned about the future. So if we don't do something about climate change and keep the seas from rising, someday maybe the Eastern Shore will be underwater. Who knows? I mean, it's a very serious problem. Yeah.
They're already having a lot of flooding there. I know that that's one of the top issues right now with this election that we're in. If you look at different parts of the state, if you look in the Hampton Roads area, that's actually gun violence is also another one, of course, because of what happened in Virginia Beach. But the second one is the environment. So they're very aware down there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Wow, this has been amazing. This has been a good conversation. We appreciate all the work that you're doing, Senator Edwards.
One other thing I've been working on. Ever since I've been the General Assembly, the second year I was there, I had a bill passed to make sure that tuition doesn't rise.
All
it's done is go up and up and up. But my bill actually passed was the state would provide two-thirds of the cost of higher education. Students, one-third, would pay for the one-third. Mm-hmm. That passed. But that's because when I ran in 1995, show you how old I am, I ran on a platform of higher education costs have gone up 64% in the previous 5 years. Mm-hmm. Well, now it's
even worse.
I don't even know what the figures are, but it's ridiculously high. And we've got to do more investing in our higher education system and get the costs down. Mm-hmm. So, you know, $1.6 trillion of student debt in the country is out there. Mm-hmm. The average student graduates about $30,000 in debt from college, not going to graduate school yet. And so $1.6 trillion is more than the total amount of credit card debt, by a little less than a trillion. Car loans, about $800 billion or something like that. That's ridiculous. Students should not be saddled with that kind of debt. It's a big impediment to their future opportunities.
The ones that really worry me are the ones who have the a degree from like a predatory institution, and we let these predatory institutions get out of control. Don't provide a good value. Yeah. A Virginia Tech degree with $30,000 worth of debt. I mean, like, I truly believe that you know, sure, you can earn that money back. Like, would I prefer you to have no debt? Yes, I would. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're not in a predatory situation there. Now, degree from a for-profit or from a place that is just kind of like a degree mill, Liberty. That's a different situation.
Yeah, and that's our federal. Those are our tax dollars going to pay for those student loans.
Oh yeah, so Liberty is technically a not for profit, but I sure see the family harvesting a lot of profits out there.
Well, I heard it was for profit.
No, I think Liberty is not for profit, but the family has their ways of harvesting the profits out of the institution.
They have 110,000 students.
Online.
Which is crazy. Yeah.
It's hard to believe that no one wants to actually be on that campus.
My goodness.
All right, we can talk about Liberty.
We'll put that on for
another segment. Episode.
Right. Well, Senator Edwards, thank you so much.
Sure.
This has been really great. I think that as we go out to vote next Tuesday, I'm sure that you will see a windfall of votes.
Good.
We need a big turnout. Doris, folks.
We need the blue wave. Yes. Big turnout.
And absolutely. Please come back anytime. You want to talk about anything, or if you want to, because again, we could talk about solar power, I think, all day. Anything we talked about today, I think we could do a whole episode on.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks.
So yeah, thanks you guys. This has been really, really great. I want to also thank James Steele and Senator Edwards for being with us today. And so as we come to a close, as always, talk a little bit about what we are looking forward to next week. So I'll start with Peter.
I think it's pretty clear. The elections. I'm looking forward to canvassing all weekend. And then seeing what the heck's going to happen on Tuesday.
So I had a beautiful day door knocking last weekend, and it was gorgeous. Mm. Beautiful weather.
Beautiful colors with the trees.
And I knocked some doors, and I'm going to be doing it again this weekend. I'm also going to be going to the Goodwill breakfast tomorrow. So those are my big things coming up. Just working on a few other things.
Yeah, pumped for Goodwill breakfast, Halloween. Always.
Yeah. It's going to be rainy. I'm worried about that.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
I don't want to get struck by lightning.
That you are. Sometimes just translates to some more spooky.
Yeah, and that'll all the witches fun. Will melt. Mm-hmm.
I might melt.
My sister's a Halloween baby. So Halloween has always been a big deal at our house. So.
Well, I mean, it's always a big deal anyways.
Well, yeah.
And then, of course, you know, impeachment. Heating up.
Yeah, it is.
And then the elections. And again, you know, whether it's banging on doors or maybe even, you know, I'm not in Roanoke County, but I have plenty of friends who are. You know, sometimes it's just as easy as calling them and saying, hey, I met James Steele, super nice guy. If you're going out to vote, check him out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I am, this weekend we actually have our state conference for the NAACP. I'm looking forward to it because we have big changes on the horizon. And so I think it'll be good and we'll be able to be much better advocates throughout the Commonwealth. So looking forward to that. And of course, Election Day.
Go NAACP.
Like, can't wait. So, well, thank you guys so much. And thank you for listening to Our Voices, Our Community, presented by Colors Virginia Magazine. You can also listen to us each Sunday at 3 p.m. on WROE 95.7 Radio Free Roanoke. If you like what you heard today, leave us a review. Also, be sure to like Our Voices, Our Community on Facebook.